The Fearless Podcast, in a time of deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act.
Right, everyone. Welcome back to the Fearless Podcast, where we talk about faith, freedom, and building systems that actually work for real people. Today, we're diving into one of the most powerful and misunderstood financial tools in the world, the infinite banking concept. My guest and good friend, Richard Canfield, is a leading educator in the infinite banking concept and a student of the late Nelson Nash. Together, we're going to discuss how this idea can become the foundation for a parallel financial system that supports local farmers, homesteaders, and agrarian families, not the banking cartel. We'll talk about how infinite banking works, how it can be applied to agriculture and community living, and how it might just become the key to true financial sovereignty. So grab a pencil and a notepad. This is going to be one of those conversations that could literally change how you think about money, ownership, and freedom. Let's jump into it. Hey, Richard, how you doing today, sir?
I'm excited, TD, to be with you today. I got to tell you, I love the sovereignty aspect, having more independence and control. I think people who are in your audience are the type of people that I like to connect with because they want to have independence. They want to do the work that's necessary to create and have that independence, you know, whether it's on their land, it's around food, it's around their health, or it's around their money. All of these things are connected in some way, and we want to be able to create and establish a good legacy. We want to leave the world or the land or our families better off than when we came in, that sort of thing. And I just love the Fearless Podcast and what you've created, but the concept of financial sovereignty is really important to me. And in my opinion, you know, what we're going to discuss today is really what it's all about.
So, Richard, before we dive into infinite banking, can you paint a picture of how the traditional banking system traps the average farmer or even the average person? I don't want to exclude anybody because this is obviously applicable to everyone, but maybe we could talk about that before we get into it.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, anyone listening in, you would have had an experience with a bank. Now, usually when we think about a bank, we're going in because we're trying to ask for money. Yeah, sure, we got to put money in. We got to deposit money. Maybe they sell you some other types of financial products, or you might think about investments or something. But for the most part, when we think about the bank, we think about going in to have a conversation with someone. Typically, we're applying for a loan or some type of financing. So really, we're talking about a financing institution. And that's what their bread and butter is. You know, they developed sometime, you know, years and years and years ago, measure of trust to make it seem like they're a safe location for you to go put, you know, open up a checking account, a savings account, and warehouse your money there. And you need to warehouse it there so it's not under your mattress, it's not in your sock or your underwear drawer, and it's not buried in a tin can, you know, behind the outhouse or something where you want to safely protect it. Because if someone knows it's there, if your house burns down, like, it's all at risk. So these brick and mortar facilities, and now in a digital world on your mobile device, these accounts have demonstrated, air quotes here, how to become some safe haven for you to store and stockpile that capital. The problem is that the moment you put it in with that institution, they immediately are able to multiply the capacity to which they can lend out to everyone else, your friends, your neighbors, the farm next door, and, you know, the acreage across the road, your family members. They're going to go get a mortgage. They're going to get a car loan. They're going to get a loan on a combine. They're going to get a loan on a grain truck, you know, a piece of equipment, whatever that is. They're borrowing from that banking institution, that financing institution, either the exact same one, especially if you're in a smaller community, it's usually the same one, or the one across the road, or the one that's, you know, on the other side of the street, and it's the same names that you see all the time. And so all we're doing is we're being caught up in a system of financial control where they're able to fundamentally manipulate the monetary supply. Because if they only need to, you know, if you have $1 or $100 in a bank account, they can create effectively $900 and lend it out to your friends because they only need to keep 10% on deposit. So that means that it's not just that they don't take your 100 and save 10 and lend 90. They keep your 100 and create 900 that didn't exist. It's called fractional reserve lending. And many of your listeners are probably already familiar with this. But that manipulation of the money supply is a real problem. And it's a real challenge. And ultimately, you don't have any control. And so we have a real problem with inflation, especially in the last, you know, 5 to 6 years, the whole Snowvid, COVID situation, as my friend James likes to call it, Snowvid. I think it's a real problem where it's manipulating the money supply. And the more dollars you have out there that aren't real, that are chasing after the same amount of goods, well, then the less valuable everything, you know, the dollar becomes, and the more valuable the good becomes. So you have this problem that's constantly being created, and a lot of that's being created because we as consumers, we, you know, it's easy to blame like the Federal Reserve, blame the central bank, blame some government, some nameless government body. But blame doesn't help you. Blame doesn't give you control. Blame doesn't let you take the reality of life back into your hands. Instead, you need actionable steps. Well, some people will do gold and silver. Some people will go get their land. These are the types of actionable steps you can do. But another thing that you can do is you can choose to be profitable and have more control by changing where you do your deposit taking, you know, deposit oriented business, and where you do your borrowing business, and move from this entity of the commercial banking sector to shifting it towards a mutually owned, mutually controlled, profitable entity called an insurance company. And when you become a co-owner in the insurance company, you get to earn part of the profits. And if they've been profitable for 200 plus years, I mean, that seems like a pretty good business to be a part of.
It's interesting that you mentioned fractional reserve banking. I don't know what happened in Canada during Snowvid, but what happened in America during Snowvid is the fractional reserve was lifted. So in America, we quite literally have a zero reserve fractional reserve. I don't know what could possibly go wrong with that. I mean, it sounds like a great idea. So much for checks and balances and all that stuff. But so in simple terms, and I realize this might be a long answer, but in simple terms, what is the infinite banking concept?
The infinite banking concept is a behavioral-based method of controlling your financial life across generations without sharing everything you work so hard for with government and banks. It's putting you in the position of control in the driver's seat of your money in a way that no other thing can. It's not an investment structure. It is about how you finance the things of life. We all need to buy things throughout life. Everything that you do is some transaction of you buying something. That buying process, that transaction of money moving from one party to another party in a relatively short period of time is the function of banking. When you need to borrow, either by using your own money and draining it to zero, or asking a third party to access a pile of money that they have, you're financing. So you're either financing with a third party, or you're financing by using your own cash, because the moment you drain your cash to zero, you have to rebuild it with payments, and you've lost the opportunity cost and the growth on that money. When you incorporate this concept of the infinite banking concept, which is concept is the important word, it's a mindset, it's a behavior. It becomes a lifestyle. It's a way that you can now harness that potential efficiently so that you can enhance your level of control for the rest of your natural life and the people you love and care about.
Well, that's why I asked you, because that's a very succinct answer of a very larger, much larger concept that goes in lots of different directions. But I would say that's a great answer. Why did Nelson Nash believe you must be your own banker? That was the solution to the monetary system, the problems we have with our current monetary system?
Super good question. I mean, there's a number of reasons. So early on, Nelson Nash, he learned about Austrian economics. He got introduced to the Foundation for Economic Education, FEE. You can go to fee.org. And his mentor, Leonard E. Reed, was one of the co-founders of that organization. And so he developed a great relationship with Leonard. And the concept, the mindset of Austrian economics is really a individual first, take care of yourself. And by taking care of yourself and being a good steward, following and abiding basic principles of human behavior. Ergo, you can become better for the people you love and care about, the community that surrounds you, and that spreads out outward. So you start inward, spreads outward. And that behavior process that Austrian economics provides, the understanding of how human behavior interacts with something they call the business cycle. And the business cycle is, you know, it's these hills and valleys, the recessions and the depressions that we see, the boom times and the bust times, which is compressed in the way that we've lived it for the last 60 years because of Keynesian thinking. So the idea that you can borrow yourself to prosperity to fund products and, you know, projects, big projects, and you can manipulate interest rates willy-nilly and not think there's going to be any damage, well, that creates a false signal to the investor, which causes these spikes of prosperity followed by like, oh, we technically falsified this prosperity because it never should have happened. And then you see a precipitous decline in the bust. And so the human behavior is a big part of that. And when institutions like central banks manipulate things like interest rates, etc., it causes those behaviors to do certain things that causes that cycle to happen on repeat. So the Austrian model, and married with well-constructed high cash value insurance designed a proper way, Nelson used to say, you know, they really need to learn how to classify things. When he was getting educated as a forester, foresters are taught to think long range, 40 years, 50 years down the road. And he said that we would take at least two courses a year while I was getting educated as a forester on how to classify things, just on how to classify things properly. And he says, if you learn to classify things properly, you're always classifying them by their major characteristics. Well, whole life insurance was grossly misclassified. It should have been called a personal monetary system with a death benefit thrown on the side for good measure. You know, that's a really long name. We would need some kind of crafty acronym to explain that to people. But the major characteristics it has much more is an alignment with a banking system than it is with its what it's known for, which is whole life insurance. And that realization, once you come to it, it's amazing what opens up for you both mentally, creatively, and then behaviorally when you can start to see how that's possible in your life.
You mentioned a couple interesting things. I was having a conversation this week, and you mentioned investors and investing. And someone said to me about, well, just buy term and invest the difference. And what's interesting as an Austrian, and if you read and understand history, just like Nelson says, right? If you don't know the problem, the solution doesn't matter. Can you explain something for me? Because, I mean, I've been in this field a very long time, participating and all that stuff. And I said, because predominantly with the mainstream propaganda, you know, the stock market is the economy. And I said, how do you explain the Dow Jones Industrial Average being at an all-time high and our buying power being at an all-time low? Because if investing was real and a thing, and, you know, if you read the books and if you're Austrian, you understand that investing in the stock market is not investing at all. It's pure speculation, which is why we have these boom and bust cycles. And it's also why there is zero correlation between the growth in the stock market and our dollar and our buying power. It's completely detached. It's inverse, right? And it's inverse for the exact reasons that you mentioned, where these banks, the banking cartel, have hyperinflated the money supply. That, I mean, before they changed the dictionary, inflation, the definition was to increase the money supply. And now magically in this new Keynesian world we live in, inflation now means, stuff's more expensive. So, you know, you brought up some really good ideas there with investing, and that speaks directly to the infinite banking concept. One, what we're doing is not an investment, And what you'll learn as you think about it and study it is that's a very good thing. That's why it works, because it's not an investment. But when it comes to IBC, what would you say? You've been a practitioner, a teacher, and a trainer now for many years. What would you say is maybe the biggest misunderstanding people have when they first hear about IBC?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I'm about to enter my 17th year since I started doing this, and I was blessed and very grateful to have spent time with Nelson Nash, and I will cherish that every day for the rest of my life. To the point that Nelson, when we were helping to create the documentary film on him called "This Is Nelson Nash," I encourage everyone to go watch that. Nelson was signing books, and he signed a lot of books before he passed away. I have my book right here that's signed by him, but I also have a copy for my son and my daughter. At the time, my daughter had just been born, and my kids are aware that they're going to receive those books, but they're not going to get them until they demonstrate that they're knowledgeable and worthy enough to handle the knowledge that's in there. They need to demonstrate certain behaviors before they're going to receive their copy of Nelson's book. And they already know that it's a treasured thing. It's a treasured item, because when we talk about Nelson, we talk about him the same way we talk about Santa Claus. You know, this bigger than life character that's a part of your life that means something. So that's how we kind of talk about Nelson, and my kids, they see pictures of him come up on screen. I have photos of my son when he was 6 months old with Nelson. So that he's a big feature in our life. And, you know, circling back to, you know, what are the objections or the things that we hear, the confusion, like people, number one, our brains are weird things. They live by a paradigm, and that paradigm tends to get more set the longer in life you go. Some of us are a little bit more neuroplastic, where we might be able to switch and ebb and flow as time goes by, but our experiences tend to harden it. So I think about like a tractor pull, where you got this tractor with big tires, and you got mud, and it's spinning its wheels. It's stuck in the ruts. You dig these big, deep ruts. And every once in a while, you can hop out of the rut, but you got to really try to work it to stay out, or else you'll slide right back in, and the whole tractor or the whole vehicle slams hard. You've experienced that before, right, TD?
Mm-hmm.
That concept is something that happens inside of our mind with our paradigm and how we begin to learn about things. Well, one of the areas where that seems to be the most fixed for a lot of people is with the word insurance. And then secondly, with the word whole life insurance. And those two things are like this dug in rut in the mind. And it causes people to become closed minded to what it might be. Again, Nelson said it was misclassified. They never should have called it that. If they called it by its primary characteristics, what it really is, we'd have a very different environment, and everyone would probably have one. And so people go through life and they end up having a buddy, a friend, a neighbor, an uncle, an aunt, who has some negative experience with insurance. Maybe it was auto, maybe it was home, maybe it was fire, maybe it was travel, maybe it was life insurance, maybe it was the person that sold it to them that didn't know anything. They have this experience, and then that experience or a friend's experience literally jades their ability to be able to be open to something that could radically improve and change their life. I find that that's one of the biggest things. And the second one that's really, I think, critically important to your question is the industry itself. It's my personal opinion that the financial industry hasn't done anyone any favors. In fact, it's probably the opposite. And the last 60 years, effectively, of North America, the entire financial machine, the advisors, and it's nothing bad or good about any of these advisors, it's the industry itself, has spent all of its energy and effort trying to separate you from your money. You go do what you're doing over here, TD. Why don't you just hand your money over to me every month, biweekly, once a year, make your deposit, do your 401k, do your 403b, do all this. You just hand it to me and let me take care of it, and you can go sit on the beach somewhere. You can go be with your family. In other words, we've spent 60 years trying to figure out how to get the wedge driven in your own mind that you can't be responsible or have the wherewithal to be in the driver's seat of your own money, and you need to abdicate that responsibility to someone else. I got news for you. The responsibility rests with you, and it always has. The fact that you've chosen to abdicate it and that they've got good marketing doesn't let you off the hook. You have to be responsible. And Nelson is bringing the ownership model of responsibility, being a steward of your own mind and your own thinking, and he's attaching it to a financial product, which is not a concept. A product is not a concept. It is a product. But you take the mindset and you attach the product to it, and then you implement practice and behaviors, and over time, you can radically shift and change the way that you operate financially, and you can feel a peaceful, stress-free way of life. Nelson used to tell me this story. You remember the 2008, well, we talked about this before, TD, the 2008 financial crisis. Everyone remembers it, unless you weren't born at that. Unless you were born in 2008, you don't remember this. But Nelson was traveling. I think he was in Austria or in Europe somewhere, and he was actually going to an Austrian economics event at the time. I don't remember. I think it was with the Mises Institute, and someone had given him tickets, and they were doing this traveling together. Well, while the news was going on about people losing money hand over fist and all the markets in crashing in the tank, Nelson's up in the morning down at the hotel lobby watching the TV, having his coffee. The person he's there with sits down beside him and says, "Oh, Nelson, what's going on?" He's like, "Well, I don't know about you, but last night my cash values went up." He said, "It's a peaceful, stress-free way of life when you get the banks out of it."
So that segues perfectly into my next question. How does liquidity inside a properly designed whole life policy compare to borrowing from a traditional bank?
That's an easy question. The answer is it doesn't. It doesn't compare at all. Because everyone listening has had an experience of trying to borrow from a bank. And unless it's the credit card, which is a little bit different, I mean, you have to jump through a bunch of hoops. You have to prove to a traditional bank that you don't need their money before they'll give it to you. And you have to sign over a bunch of documents, papers, your firstborn child, all of these things. And if you don't have some of the pieces in place, they make you go run around, try to find all the documents. You're really almost made to feel like some kind of a second-class citizen a lot, unless you're in a good financial position and you've gotten through all those hoops, you've done everything possibly right, you've got the great credit score. Maybe you don't have the same problems that everyone else does, but there was a point in time in your life where you probably did. And the key thing is, every single time that you go for some type of financing, you're signing on the dotted line, and that signature is a pledge to repay. And that pledge is actually basically against your future earning potential or the collateral of an asset. So if there's no collateralized asset, the asset is your income. It's your future income stream. There's still a collateralized asset. It's just actually you as the human being. You don't even realize that's what's happening. It's almost a version of enslavement, financial enslavement. When it comes to collateralizing a secured asset, well, they want you to have security, but they try to convince you that you should give up the security because you're going to get better rates, better terms, better this. And so we willingly do it and we give up the security or else you won't get the loan. So it's a constant battle of them being in the driver's seat instead of you. And here's the thing, what people don't realize, if you look at a balance sheet, you have assets and you have liabilities. Every balance sheet's assets and liabilities. Well, the personal person's balance sheet, assets is like the house and the car and all these things that aren't really assets because they cost you money fundamentally. They might be an investment, but they're not necessarily an asset. And liabilities are loans to third parties. All right. Well, you take a bank and you flip it. The bank has assets and liabilities. The assets are the loans. The liabilities are the savings accounts and the checking accounts and the deposits. Your deposit at a bank is the bank's liability. They owe you that money. That bank statement, that digital ledger, that mobile phone that says how much you have in there, that is technically an IOU that the bank owes you that money because they're using your money and they're charging you fees to get your money so that they can lend it to everyone else you know and make a massive profit. That should bother you. It bothers me. TD, I'm pretty sure it bothers you. So in order to change positions, if that is a great business model, which it's been clearly demonstrated over a thousand years that is a really good business model. If banks have the biggest buildings with the biggest names in every major city in the planet, wouldn't you want to think there and wonder, well, why don't I own one of those? Why? What is it that I could do differently in my life to have some portion of that? So what Nelson has taught us through his book, Becoming Your Own Banker, is how you can separate yourself, like unplugging a fan or a heater from the wall. How do you unplug yourself from their system and plug into one that you have more control over? You might not be able to transfer all of that financial energy overnight, and no one would expect you to. But if you don't start the process somewhere, I can guarantee you it's not going to happen. You have to start somewhere. Here's the other thing. This is really important. People who want to live off their land, have more control over their food, more health, that sort of thing, have that independence and control. They're taking the time to learn and get educated. This is another area of your life where you need to do that. To expect that we can just vote our way to a better financial system is completely ludicrous. It's not designed that way. You will not make that change. So what Nelson discovered, and this is one thing that he was extremely proud of, and I'm 100% with him on this, was that you can secede. Secession matters. You can secede from everyone else's way of thinking, and you don't have to ask permission. You don't need to get, everyone's trying to look for what Nelson would call a top-down solution. What you really need is you need a bottom-up solution to a top-down problem. Well, the way you create a bottom-up solution, you go get your own piece of land. You learn how to grow your own vegetables. You learn how to, butcher your own meat. You learn how to hunt. You learn how to do all this stuff. You learn how to become your own banker. You don't become your own banker overnight. You learn how to do it. And Nelson's book is 92 pages. That's a perfect guide on how to do it.
I quite literally 2 days ago, I posted a video and I was talking about what led me to permaculture. And one of the original architects of permaculture was a guy by the name of Bill Mollison. And I forget which book it's in, but Bill Mollison said, permaculture is sedition. And I said, that's what attracted me to permaculture, because I learned that I could take control of our food process and control that function of growing our own food. We know what we fertilize with, growing our own cows. I could take control of that function. And by taking control of it, I am eliminating the need for the modern big ag infrastructure, right? I could secede from that. I didn't have to vote for somebody. I didn't have to wait. I didn't have to wait for the USDA or any of these other bureaucratic agencies. I could secede from that. And then I said, that is exactly what led me to IBC when I learned that I could secede from the banking system that is quite literally starting every known war and all the current wars. It's obviously financing that, and the war on the family, the war on children, whether it's abortion or whatever it is, right? And I can secede from that using the infinite banking concept. And that's exactly what I was just talking about 2 days ago. So in the vein of farming, ranching, growing your own food, how can a farmer or rancher use IBC to replace or reduce dependence on ag loans or operating lines of credit?
Love that. And that's what we talk about in our book, Growing Your Own Capital, which you're one of the first people to read a copy of that book, TD, which we appreciate, and we appreciate your feedback on it. It's really how you control the financing for your farm operation, developing the ultimate line of credit that your family benefits from, and also how do you keep the farm in the family? Well, one of the ways, a surefire way to not keep the farm in the family is to have a whole bunch of debt to a third party and then not communicate to the family how to deal with it when you're dead. So that's not going to help you keep the farm in the family. We can be really clear on that. And as soon as you identify something as simple as that, you can start to figure, okay, well, what might I do differently? In order to separate from the financial system, you have to meet with someone, number one, who's knowledgeable about it. You have to be ready and willing to have a good assessment of what's going on and have a new person give you a way of looking at it, because probability is your way of looking at it is isolated, and you need a second pair of eyeballs. It's like, every once in a while you're building a fence to keep some cattle in. Well, you want to run a straight line, so you're on the property line. You're not on the neighbor's property line. Every once in a while, you're going. But if you don't stop, walk back, take a look, make sure you're running the line properly. You got to look at it from a long distance, because you can see a long distance of what posts you've put in. Whereas when you're putting that post in, you only have one perspective. That's what's happening in a lot of farmers' lives. And so you need to get another perspective to look at it. And you have to be open to what that is. And you have to start somewhere. So one thing about like a lot of farm operations is that they have a different payment structure than most other people. They might be making quarterlies or annual payments or semi-annual payments on things. They're the only people pretty much on the planet that get that kind of payment structure. Everyone else is doing monthlies. For the most part, or bi-weeklies or weeklies or accelerated whatever. And that's because you know why they do that? The bank does it because they want to earn interest on you and they want the payment. So they're going to figure out whatever they need to do to make it easy for you to get the payment. And they're not stupid. They understand that harvest only comes once a year. So if you got grain crops or whatever it is, depending on your growing season, like what you're doing, you know, you got barley, you got hay, you whatever it is you've got canola. Well, you're waiting till the end of summer and autumn. You got to rally everyone together. You're working 24/7. It's 1 a.m. and you're in the tractor, in the combine, trying to get things down. You know that you're going to be taking it to market, but the market price with commodities is all over the map. Also a function that you don't control. You're literally positioning yourself to build and grow your revenue and your survival around market factors you have zero control over. You can't control the rain. You can't control the environment. You can't control the rules around the environment. You can't control if the bank says, hey, we'll only give you this ag loan if you're using this type of fertilizer or you have to be using fertilizer. So if you want to be a regenerative farmer, and you want to take 3 or 4 years to turn over this one chunk of land into a regenerative operation, how much financing are you going to get on that? They're not too keen on that because they don't know the proof of your yield and they don't want to go to bat with you on that deal. But yet you need to get enough yield so you can make payments on your tractor. Like you're just caught in this loop and this cycle. And what happens is they lock you into a prison of control and it's really hard to break free. So you have to break free in subtle increments. Number one, you got to look at your profits. You got to look at the cash flowing through your machine. And because it comes in lump sum chunks, when it comes in, but you might be waiting 2, 3, 4, 5 months before it has to go out again. You might sell at harvest and then you got to go buy fertilizer, you got to buy seed, you got to get some things, but you're not spending some of that money until spring. You got to live on a little bit. Well, can you capture some of that financial energy captured inside of an entity and a machine you have control over and put yourself in a position where you can slowly buy yourself out of the prison you've created? The reality is that's where it usually begins for most farm families.
So would you say that this system can be scaled to support local agrarian economies, for example, co-ops, local processors, and markets? This is this new, there's a lot of growth in this area thanks to COVID and very brittle supply chains. Is this scalable?
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely do believe it is. And in a couple of ways, some of them are a little bit maybe more philosophical by nature, I guess, in the grand scheme. But if you really think it through, I think it would make sense that way. But from an example of when you have people who've already been to some degree ousted from the system, let's say the financing in the supply chain system that they were accustomed to, because life has changed, the world has changed around them, and they're trying to make changes for what they believe in their value system is better decisions. Well, then what's going to happen is they got to figure out how to do it on their own. They're going to run with their own, they're going to pay cash for things. And then every time they do that, they're burning through their own cash. So can we harness that cash to make it work for you and your family a longer period of time? And or they're trying to work within their smaller communities. So maybe there's a little bit more barter happening. There's a little bit more, internal borrowing from family members or from other community individuals. And so if that's already taking place, what you've got is you've got a micro economy happening there. And so you can take the energy of that micro economy and you can make it actually very functional and very profitable. In fact, this is one of the reasons why people say shop local, shop at home, that sort of thing, because the more that a dollar turns over in a micro environment like that, the local community, the local town, you know, you need a lawyer, you go to the lawyer in local community. The lawyer needs an accountant, he goes and pays the accountant with your money. The accountant needs to go buy a cow, he buys a cow from TD. You know, that turn of energy, it actually creates a great deal of prosperity. So the more that we can put it in that community environment, the better it is. Where this makes a lot of sense is when we talk about the product. So again, concept, most important. product does matter, but once you understand its fundamentals, it's actually quite boring. Not everyone thinks, I think it's pretty exciting, but a lot of people, really, on the grand scheme, it's pretty boring. But when we're doing business with a mutually owned insurance company, mutual means we mutually own it. No, there's no stockholders, no outside forces. 100% of their decisions are literally designed to support their owners, which includes you. It's kind of like a co-op model. It's very similar. And because of that co-op model, well, they're going to share profits with you. That's called dividends. And those go back into your machine, and it makes your machine more efficient each and every year. It's like having a combine that you know is gonna be able to work on your farm for the rest of your life. It actually gets better over time. It doesn't degrade. It improves its output each and every year. And it takes less fuel fundamentally for it to do that. That's the type of machine we're getting, only it's financial. And unlike a combine that only works 2, maybe 3 weeks out of the year, this one works every day, regardless of what you do with it.
Yeah, and this was the epiphany that I had. Joel Salatin has been talking about this homestead tsunami. And once I started implementing this concept and expanding it, I truly see it, certainly for our family and our local community, if it were just our family even, I really see IBC as the financial engine for the modern homesteading movement.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. There was a book that Nelson gave me. He was such an interesting character. He was providing books to people and sending books out right before he passed away. And he would send them out to people. He would buy them and send them. And he had a huge collection of books. He was an avid reader. And I remember receiving a book for him. It was probably about maybe 2 years before he passed away. And it's a book that you might appreciate. And I think maybe you've even read it. It's called Restoring America, One County at a Time. It's by Joel McDermott. And he's a theologian, I'm pretty sure, is what his, you know, accurate title is. But it's a great book, and it talks exactly what we're talking about, how we need to get back to this smaller community mindset model, where we're doing things at the local environment. And if we just focused on you, your family, the local environment, your friends and neighbors, and we put our energy into being good neighbors, and we did that environment, and we did it, and then what happens is that expands. It's like a rock in a pond. So by having these communities back to that smaller county environment, the localization of everything, you're creating really profitable and powerful rocks in that pond, and that expands out to the societal level. Well, the same thing applies with the implementation of IBC. And Nelson liked that book because he felt this fella is writing about everything I believe in. He's just, the only link that he's missing is the banking component, but it's okay. He doesn't need to worry about it because I've already got that solved. People just need to grab his book and my book and they're good.
Yeah, and that was another thing. I think Nelson had a goal of reaching 10%. And, you know, he tried to do it top down. He tried to do it by educating the insurance companies, but he came to the realization like that's completely unnecessary. If we do it from the bottom up and do it on the individual level, we could quite literally, if we could reach a tipping point of say 10%, we could quite literally not just remove the financial power of the banking cartel, but quite literally topple and destroy the banking cartel, whether or not they would obviously shift and change and juke and jive. But it certainly would be destroyed from our perspective, because we don't need to utilize them or ask them for any favors.
Well, and interestingly enough, I'll share a quick story with you about that. That's very recent. Before I do that, you got me thinking, you know, one of the other reasons that this mutual insurance matters is, think about your friends and your neighbors. They're people that love and care about their families. Well, people that love and care about their families and want them looked after are the types of people that go and get life insurance, specifically whole life insurance. They have to have some idea, vision, concept, drive, and desire to care enough about their loved ones to make that a reality in their life. So if that is true, which it is, then what kind of an amazing business relationship to be in than with an organization where everyone is doing that. They all care about their families to the degree that you do. And by default, even though you don't know who those people are, the virtue of them being there, ergo, should indicate that they care about their legacy in some way. It's an automatic selection process, and the insurance company does it for you, which is pretty cool. Now, talking about top-down thinking and the struggle, Nelson did have a lot of struggle dealing with insurance company. He had told some great stories about being in the CEO's office, having the whole board there, having the legal team there. And their number one thing is, well, is this compliant? I'm like, well, how do you take an idea and make it compliant? I'm not talking about a product, man. It's an idea. A concept isn't compliant, right? And so that's enough to make him, you know, flip his desk over and leave the room. In fact, he almost did that a couple of times. But just a couple of weeks ago, TD, it was maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago, I was in Cincinnati and I was delivering a course, which we've built with my colleagues. And so as a member of the Nelson Nash Institute, I've been invited to be on what's referred to as the Practitioner Council. So there's a group of us who have been nominated by the Nelson Nash Institute to advise and support them on initiatives that help grow the 10% of advisors to teach this concept, which is our focus. And it's a volunteer position. And so we help develop and build a coaching academy with the Nelson Nash Institute. And so any new person now that comes into that program, they're required to take that in their first year. It's a 2-day session. And we have a lot of existing practitioners who are coming through, which is fantastic. We had about 40 professionals in this room in Cincinnati. The reason I bring it up is that it was actually hosted by one of these life carriers. Now, they're not endorsing or supporting it because compliance and the legal team would never agree to that. But they come and sponsor our annual think tank event. There's only a select group of them that do that. And they attend these events every year. Now, I've emceed that event. It typically runs usually right after Super Bowl, every February, typically. Often it's hosted in Birmingham, Alabama. This year, I'll be emceeing the event again. I think it'll be my fourth year in a row. And I did it once when Nelson was still here. And I'm the only person who's emceed it that's not a member of the Nelson Nash, that's not on the board of directors. And so I'm very honored and grateful that that's the case. But I've had the pleasure of interviewing these life companies and their representatives and the presidents, CEOs coming on stage, sharing about the industry and how they value our business, but why our business is different compared to what's on the books. Because a lot of people sell insurance and they just get insurance and they don't know what to do. A lot of people sell the concept, what they think it is, and they're totally wrong. And what happens is you have a lot of people robbing Peter to pay Paul. They get an insurance policy. They're told that they're doing infinite banking, which is wrong. They borrow from it. They never make repayments. They spend all the money. They're no better off financially because they have no coaching, no mindset, no behaviors. You remove the right mindset, the right behavior from the process, and you have nothing. Everything begins there. Nelson's book, Becoming Your Own Banker, if you strip out some numbers and a couple of blank pages, like the contents and the glossary and, the publishing information, when you break it down to the 92 pages, there's only about 77 pages you actually need to read. And out of those 77 pages, 33% of the entire book is built based on human behavior. So 1/3 of everything in here is about your behavior, and it's all at the front. By the way, if all you did was got that information and you never implemented this, your life will be better off.
Speaking of human behavior, let's say somebody's thinking about implementing infinite banking. What would you recommend as what should be their first step?
Step number one is always reading Nelson's book. Now, we have a way that we send out an email or a letter where we recommend reading it. Because the book was created as a workbook for a 10-hour seminar, it's actually the first sentence in the book, by the way, it doesn't read necessarily like a typical or a normal book that you would buy in the bookstore. So I have an unconventional, Nelson was an unconventional guy, so am I, and so I have an unconventional way that I recommend people read it, where you actually start on page 85, which is my favorite page, and then you go to page 3 and 4, and you read it twice before you move anywhere further. So it's a little bit unorthodox, but I've had a lot of people tell me that they really appreciated and liked those instructions. So you read Nelson's book. Nelson's book will determine if it's something you're interested in. If you either are and you aren't, and either way is fine. What's it going to cost you? $20, $25 to determine if you want to make a radical change in how you process and use your financial energy running through your hands for the rest of your life. That's a pretty low commitment. You got to budget about 2 hours, maybe 2.5 hours tops out of your time. You should be doing that if you're planning to make changes or do something major in your financial life anyway. The reality is, people will spend more time trying to hire a plumber than they're going to spend reading this book, which is completely ridiculous. You'll spend more time reading reviews on the right plumber to call than you would educating your family about a life-changing generational financial path. Totally insane to me, in my opinion. But that would be step one. And then I would really encourage people, because what happens, TD, is most households have one primary financial partner who does all their learning and all the research and gets all the excitement. And then they have one partner who is not as much engaged, but they always have veto power. And you want to be on the same page. You know, you like music. Well, you want to make sure that when you walk into a room, you don't have two different radios playing. One's got AC/DC and the other one's playing like Mozart. That's not going to sound very good. You want to make sure you're reading from the same sheet of music. In my personal opinion, the person that does the greatest job of that is Nelson. And so that's one of the reasons that This Is Nelson Nash, the documentary film, is so amazing, because I consider Nelson to be the spouse whisperer. Anytime that I've had people where there's a disconnect in the spouse, I say, look, get your spouse's favorite beverage, get their favorite snack, get their cozy blanket, set up a period of time where you're going to sit down together for 1 hour. You throw it up on the smart TV from YouTube. You sit down and you watch it together. Let Nelson explain things. You don't need to be the expert. Let Nelson do it for you. And at the end of that, they're going to walk away either thinking this guy was amazing or this is not for me. What's the harm? It's 1 hour with your spouse with a tasty beverage and a nice snack. I could think of a worse way to spend a, you know, Friday afternoon.
Great advice. We just this morning implemented, one of my subscribers said, you know, it would be really great if you did like a book club. So I made a recommendation on a book. So what I'll do is I'm going to link the book down below, and this will be the second book in the book club. And so if you're interested in getting more information, check out the book. Obviously, read it. Sometimes you have to be a little more direct with people today. they can't pick up the inferences. So read the book. And I guess in closing, I think this would be a great summary and synopsis. If Nelson Nash were here today, what do you think he'd say about the state of our modern banking system and the opportunity we have to build something better?
He would be very excited about the opportunity. He loved connecting with people of all ages, and he poured a lot of his energy into youth. He really recognized, he understood that you got to think long range. You got to learn how to think beyond your own lifespan. And he was tickled pink coming to the last think tank before he passed away. It'll be this coming March 2026 will be 6 years since Nelson graduated. And we were able to air the documentary film at a theater in Birmingham, had like 250 people there. And he was able to see it with his family and all these amazing people from the Nelson Nash Institute. It was a really glorious event. And there was people from the Mises Institute there, from all these different, you know, think tanks, Foundation for Economic Education, and so on. And there to pay respect to Nelson and watch that film. So he got to be there for that. And it was about a month later where he went in for a surgery that he didn't think he was coming out of. And so he was calling people from the hospital room. He was calling people right up until probably 4 hours before they took him in for surgery. That's the kind of guy he was. He never stopped because he believed in what he was doing. He had quadruple bypass heart surgery in 1988. And he said, you know, there's this beautiful machine called a heart-lung machine. And if it wasn't for the heart-lung machine, we would be talking about me in the past tense, okay? The heart-lung machine does everything that a heart can do, except it only does it marginally so. It just is enough to basically keep you alive, and that's it. And the financial world, the people in the world that we live in today, consumers, they are living on the equivalent of a heart-lung machine financially, and they don't realize that that's the case. They don't know what it might feel like if you really got the blood pumping. And Nelson would take every little thing and turn it into an incredible analogy like that. And so he was so excited about the direction and the things that were happening with the Nelson Nash Institute. If he saw how we were growing as an organization, the amount of advisors and new people coming in, and how young some of them are, he would be really excited. in relation to the financial system, I mean, he wouldn't be disappointed about it because he just knew that was happening anyway. There's a lot of other things he would be bothered and frustrated by, but then Nelson would focus on the bright lights. He would look at the people like yourself who are taking some measure of a stand about what they stand for, what they value, and making their stand known in the world that there is another way. You can be different. You can do different. You can buck the trend. You don't have to just toe the line and be a sheep in like the rest of everyone else. And he would be inspired by that. And I think there's a lot of that happening right now. And I think there's an increasing amount of it because the pendulum swings. And maybe I'm being optimistic. I don't know. I think Nelson was a fairly good optimist himself. My gut, the feeling that I have is that the pendulum is starting to swing back to a degree of control. While there is a lot of chaos and a lot of stuff out there, there's an awful lot of bright lights too. And if you focus on the bright lights, you'd be amazed at how much they can begin to cascade. You know, and I'll say one more thing just about the book, TD, as well, for your listeners. My partner Jason and I, who with our podcast, Wealth on Main Street, we did a deep dive into Nelson's book, and we did it actually, we had two live webinars. They were 2 hours apiece, but we condensed them down to about 45 minutes a shot, and there's two parts. And one is us going through various areas of the book in detail. We have the book up, we're highlighting and talking through things that we learned from Nelson, things that Nelson would deliver in his 10-hour seminar. And then part two of that is us deep diving into one area of the book, which is generally the most confusing area of the book that people get held up on. And that's the equipment financing example. Well, I'd be happy to get you those links. And then you can, if you want, you can put them in the show notes and then people Perfect. Can dig into those. So they get a copy, they read the book. They can have these guides along with them to literally, we did it so that you could have the book and literally walk through it like you were in the seminar live with Nelson was the idea.
That would be fabulous. And yeah, I'll put those links down below. I'll link Richard's YouTube channel, Wealth on Main Street, and how you can get a hold of more of his information. That's actually how Richard and I connected. I consumed an inordinate amount of their information. And that's why we kind of reached out to each other. And so now, you know, in closing, if you take one thing away from today, it's this. You don't have to play by the system's rules, whether it's the food system or whether it's the banking system. You can build your own one that keeps wealth circulating among families, farms, and communities that share your values. To learn more about the infinite banking concept, check out, obviously get the book, check out the links below. And as always, if you enjoyed this episode, please share it with your friends and family. For anyone that's ready to think deeper about freedom, faith, and finance. Until next time, stay fearless, stay free, and keep building. Thanks, Richard. Appreciate you, brother.
Thanks, man. Happy to do it.